What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping
you? I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. Glad to have you with us. This program is for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Hey, if that is you, perhaps you're a Methodist, perhaps you are a Southern Baptist, perhaps you're a Buddhist, whatever, and you've got a question about the Catholic faith and you want to know the actual truth, what does the Catholic Church actually teach? We are here for you. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. You will then get a robo response from us automatically. Once you get that, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. If you're watching us on TV today, you can participate as well by sending us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kubinski is our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you would like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms, just put your question in the chat screen. Rich will handle things from there. I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing decent. Thank you.
Interesting question here from Marlon, who says, what was the evidence of Peter, St. Peter, handing off his authority to another person?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. The question, I think, misrepresents the Catholic doctrine on apostolic succession, meaning that's not how apostolic succession works. It's not like the reigning bishop in a diocese, in order to have a legitimate successor, it literally passes the baton. He doesn't name a successor and then hand him the keys of the office and walk out the door. Interestingly, that does happen. it's just not necessary. Like, so if the bishop dies in office, then there are legitimate mechanisms for appointing a successor to that apostolic see, and that successor is the bishop of that particular locale in virtue of occupying the jurisdiction and arriving at that position in legal means, whether or not the previous occupant tapped that person and literally handed the keys over. Now, as an aside, at least in the United States, the way some dioceses are governed corporately is they will have, not all dioceses work this way, but they'll be corporation sole, meaning the bishop physically owns the property.
Uh-huh.
And so after the installation of the bishop ecclesiastically, all the lawyers and the right people will meet in the back room and they'll literally sign the papers and transfer title to diocesan property from one bishop to another. So
wow.
there can actually be a sort of handing on like that. But that's not a part of the theology of the episcopacy. It's not necessary for apostolic succession. So it is not necessary in Catholic theology for Peter to have personally named a successor in order for him to have a legitimate successor, right?
Okay.
So you're looking for evidence of something for which there's no necessity, right? The idea of apostolic succession is in sacred scripture and in sacred tradition, and you find it in another number of places. So first of all, in Acts chapter 14, we learned it is the apostles who were appointing the pastoral successors in the churches that they founded. It says that explicitly in the text. Go look it up, right? In the pastoral epistles, St. Paul says to Timothy and Titus, well, I am Paul, and I appointed you Titus, and I appointed you Timothy, so that you can have this apostolic charge and hand on the faith after me, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you see the concept in there. And then it's elaborated in early second century Christian literature in the likes of Irenaeus of Lyon and Ignatius of Antioch and even Tertullian, who eventually left the church. All of them acknowledge this process of the handing out of apostolic authority. But it attaches to what we call the see, S-E-E, which is the jurisdictional location that the bishop occupies.
Territory.
Right, but the territory,
okay.
Exactly. Rather than some sort of sort of personal charism that's laid, you know, handed on from one bishop directly to another as if you're passing a baton in a race. The evidence for Peter ending his episcopacy at Rome and the Petrine primacy specifically attaching to that see is not found in the New Testament, but is presupposed in sacred tradition.
Okay. Marlon, thanks so much for your email. Here's one from Eve. If God claims to forgive our sins in confession, then why do we have to go to purgatory?
Yeah, exactly. So let's back up to a human analogy.
Okay. All right.
Imagine one that I've used 100 times. I'll use it again. Imagine that I give my child the instruction not to throw the baseball in the house, and the kid throws the baseball in the house, and then he comes to me in sorrow and says, "I'm terribly sorry. Is this it? I'm going to be written out of the will. You're disinheriting me. You're throwing me out of my... I'm only in second grade, but I've got to go make my way in the world, you know?" I'm like, "No, son. No. Our relationship is not ruptured. You know, you're sorry. I forgive you. We're reconciled." Every parent understands this reality. There's no enmity between us anymore. However, here is the dustpan and the broom. Go clean up the mess.
Yeah.
Now, if I, as a parent, hand the child the dustpan and the broom, is that a condition of them continuing to live in my good grace? Is it a condition of forgiveness? No.
No.
I'm not going to throw the kid out of the house if he doesn't do this right, you know? I do that for his own moral benefit. I mean, it really doesn't help me that much. I mean, I'd probably do a better job cleaning it up myself and get it done faster, right?
Yeah.
But I do that because I want him to learn responsibility. And so I make him take responsibility for his actions. And in justice, even though he may do a half-baked job, there's some kind of proportionality there. There's some sort of rectitude in him making an attempt to clean up his mess, right? That's what penance and purgatory are in the Christian life. They're not a condition to win God's forgiveness. They presuppose God's forgiveness. But they are just like the kid who cleans up his mess. They're some kind of, even if it is half-baked attempt on our part, to rectify the disorder that we brought into the family.
And that's how it works. Thank you so much, Eve, for your email. Again, if you'd like to send us an email for a future show, the address ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to get to Cecil in Murrieta, California. We have some lines open for you as well. Wow. 833-288-EWTN is that number. 833-288-3986. Or if you prefer, text the letters EWTN to 58177. 58177 is that text number. More in a moment with Dr. David Andrews here on Call to Communion on EWTN. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Andrews here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Before we go to the phones, let me tell you about something beautiful now available from EWTN's religious catalog. You can grace any spot in your home with a beautiful crucifix. It is made with a rich, dark brown, solid walnut cross. And on that cross hangs a somber representation of Jesus, post-mortem, which is made of resin, but it has the appearance of a wood carving with beautiful features. This cross measures almost 21 inches long, the corpus 11 inches. A hinged triangular brass hook on the back makes it very easy to hang. Check it out right now by going to EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic. EWTNRC.com. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with Cecil in Murrieta, California, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Cecil. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I'm a licensed counselor, and I have a client who, when I try to introduce the idea of an interior life, helping him develop an interior life, he says, "Well, that's not real. That's fake. That's imagination, and that's not real knowledge." I try to introduce, you know, St. Ignatius of Loyola, or I've been looking at the idea of a university by Cardinal Newman. He talks about different kinds of knowledge. His background is Russian Orthodox. I don't know if that has anything to do with it, but he you would think that he would have a little bit understanding of the idea of mystery and appreciate that kind of understanding of a revelatory knowledge, I guess you could say. But anyway, I've never had a client quite tell me that it's just not real, the idea of an interior life. Maybe you could help me with that.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So there is a French Protestant philosopher named Henri Corbin, who introduced a term to this religious discourse called not imagination, but the imaginal. And it's a way of utilizing your creative interior capacities that's distinct from mere imagination. I'll define my terms here. So if I said to you, okay, I want you to imagine, a golden retriever.
Okay.
All right. You can form the mental picture in your mind of a, you know, fluffy, golden, happy, slobbery, waggy thing running
Got
around.
It.
Okay.
Got it.
That's not so interesting. And that's, you know, people poo-poo imagination. The imaginal is the ability to place yourself creatively in a posture or position or frame of reference that's counterfactual, like the kid who puts on a cape and says, I'm Superman, right? He's not picturing Superman in his mind. He's trying on the identity in the world of being Superman.
Okay.
And what would it be like to go through life as Superman? Okay. Now it turns out that capacity to place yourself creatively and, if you will, imaginatively within a particular frame of reference that's counterfactual is central to our moral, rational, intellectual agency. Right, it's highly implicated in human cognition and in intensely positive ways. One way that we do this all the time is we place ourselves in the position of our future self. Right, we are able to anticipate circumstances that are counterfactual, like they're not actually happening to us. Right?
Yeah.
And our ability to do that effectively, our lives literally depend on it. You get this wrong, and you're dead. Right, you fail to anticipate how you will react under certain circumstances, like, you know, Coyote is always doing when he's going after a roadrunner. He's always failing to anticipate properly how his body will react under certain circumstances.
Yep.
And unlike Coyote, we don't get to fall off the, you know, the 2,000-foot precipice and go splat at the bottom and then accordion ourselves back up and go on for the next round in the Looney Tunes cartoon.
Yeah.
Like, we're dead if that happens to us, right?
Yep.
We are all able to do this sometimes pathologically, but sometimes very beneficially with respect to our own pasts. You know, when I sort of mentally project myself into my own, you know, narrative history, I can get stuck in reminiscence and remorse and regret and nostalgia, and those things can become quite pathological. But I can also just quite frankly learn from my mistakes and go, oh, I did it that way, it didn't work, I'll try it this way, right? So we're always projecting ourselves through our capacity for narrative and autobiography, extending our agency into the past, into the future, in ways that are not, well, they're not tangible, but to say they're not real would be a real misjudgment of the way human cognition works and the way human agency works, okay? And these are, I mean, this is not woo-woo stuff. I'm not talking about, you know, angels whispering in your ear. I'm just talking about the way human cognition works, the way we interact with our own minds, our capacity for the imaginal and for counterfactual situations. Is absolutely central to our ability to function as rational moral agents and to survive and thrive. Okay, any entrepreneur would tell you the same thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, his capacity to imagine a world in which, you know, say, you know, thin flat computing objects could create a $1 trillion company can come to fruition, right? Which is exactly why the metaphor of the apple with the bite taken out of it is why Steve Jobs chose that for his company, right? So it's essential. A lot of spirituality is about playing with this capacity and trying to consciously hack our own cognition and our own internal architecture to bring about our own and others' human flourishing, right? So think about the case, for example, did you mention Ignatius of Loyola? If you didn't, you said something.
I believe so, yeah.
You think about Ignatius. So what is it? What do we know about Ignatius's own autobiography? Well, this kind of thing was absolutely integral to his autobiography. So he has one role that he's playing in life. That's the role of a soldier. He gets his leg blown off. Now, a lot of people are convalescing when their leg's blown off, and they say, well, there goes my career as a soldier down the drain. Boo-hoo-hoo, poor me. I guess I'll get addicted to opioids, right? And that happens to a lot of people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
What does he do? He's sitting in bed. He reaches over, and he pulls a book of the Lives of the Saints off the shelf, and he starts reading it. And what does he do? Little kid puts on a cape, says, I'm Superman.
Yeah.
In his mind, he puts on a cape and says, I'm St. Francis. I'm St. Dominic.
Yeah.
I'm St. Whoever. I could do that too. And he is able to reimagine his life along a completely different trajectory by reaching into the Catholic past, trying on a new identity,
mm-hmm.
projecting it into the future. Are past and future mm-hmm. real things? Absolutely. Not in the way your client's thinking of. But again, you don't take these things into consideration, you're a dead man, right? But because he consciously engages this agency, he's not just the victim of it. It's not just happenstance. He's not just allowing his ruminative associations to progress randomly. He's adopting the disciplines of a Catholic spiritual tradition in order to shape his future self in a particular direction. And Ignatius is clearly one of the most interesting, seminal, and significant figures, not only to Catholicism, but to the world. You know, Father Mitch was telling me the other day that a particular Asian country, I don't know if this is public knowledge, so I won't name the country,
okay,
that, let's say, has not had the best record of pulling its people into modernity, recognized that they needed to seriously upgrade their educational infrastructure. And so what did they do? Did they reach out to the UN? Did they reach out to the American Department of Education? They reached out to the Jesuits.
Wow.
Because he said, you guys have the longest track record of doing this. And so they brought the Jesuits on board to bring their population up to speed in
wow.
terms of educational accomplishments, right? Ignatius had a transformative impact on world culture, right? Primarily through the educational wing, right? And where did it begin? It began in his religious and moral imagination, right? And it started, he was able to cultivate it through very intentional spiritual practices. Now, he created a system to put his shock troops through, his Jesuit recruits, called the spiritual exercises.
Yep.
That's all they are. All they are is an exercise in the imaginal. Put on the identity of Christ's disciples. Change your self-conception. Project yourself into the future so that you're formed in such a way that you can make an intelligent, moral choice about the direction of your life. The entire thing is an exercise in the imaginal that has profoundly concrete results, namely the creation of people whose whole orientation in life is towards creating positive change in the world to better humanity, their own spiritual lives, the church, for the glory of God.
Cecil, is that helpful for you, sir?
Oh, that's very, very helpful, and I'll take a look at that book that you mentioned by the Imaginal.
Oh, sure.
That sounds really helpful. Thank you. So
you might
much.
Also, to be honest with you, I'm indebted to the cognitive scientist John Vervaeke for a lot of that insight. He just recently gave a lecture called "Why Reason Needs Spirit."
Ooh.
On precisely this topic, and some of those illustrations are drawn from Vervaeke. So give credit where credit's due.
And I don't know about other people, but I learned a new word today, imaginal.
Imaginal, yeah.
Brand new word for me. I'll have to look further into that. Cecil, thanks so much for your call today. That opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Let's go now to Emma. Emma is a first-time caller in Hayden, Iowa, listening today on the EWTN app. Hello, Emma. What's on your mind today?
Hi. I'm in Idaho.
Idaho. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Hey, Dr. Anders, I used to hate you with a white hot hate. And I used to yell at you constantly. I thought you were the biggest idiot. But I kept listening. I'm Catholic now.
Oh, I love this. This is wonderful. I love it when people think I'm an idiot.
You and Catholic Answers. I really hated them.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So
well,
I just want all Protestants to continue to listen. Because if you continue to listen, you see the history, the structure of the church, and everything else is the way it's supposed to be.
So I really appreciate this call. I love it when people tune in and think I'm an idiot, especially if I make them sufficiently mad that they have just got to listen to more because they have to, I don't know, feed that dark side of their personality that cultivates their hatred and ire and wrath at this Catholic idiot on the radio. Not a few people have had this response of calling in and thinking Andrews is a complete idiot, and they're half right there, you know. And then it's not me, it's the Catholic tradition that's so enriching and so much wisdom and so compelling. I mean, I felt the same way. I mean, I wanted nothing to do with Catholics whatsoever at all. When I first started encountering Catholic stuff, I was like, oh, you know, this is terrible, awful stuff. And eventually the logic of the Catholic position just started to work on me, and I realized this makes a lot more sense than the tradition that I'm coming out of. Darn! Like, I don't want to be Catholic! And then eventually, you know, your conscience takes a hold of you and sort of leads you by the nose. And it was like, you know, shucks, I guess I'm going to have to be Catholic. You know, I mean, I got no choice in the matter now, you know. But I totally relate to that. So I really appreciate that. Now, there's something I'd like to make a comment about your trajectory, okay? And that is that Newman told us a long time ago that people do not change their minds, particularly about identity-forming beliefs, in response to the syllogistic reasoning of deductive logic. You know, you present somebody with a deductive argument for the truth of the Catholic faith, they are not going to be convinced. And in fact, the First Vatican Council actually taught as a dogma, if you think there is an argument that will definitively compel the intellect to accept the contents of the Catholic faith, well, guess what? You're a heretic. Like, it doesn't work that way, okay? And Newman said, look, the way people make decisions, the way they form their beliefs, particularly on these identity-forming issues, is that the propositions that are compelling to them are the ones that confirm mm-hmm. their basic intuitions about the world, mm-hmm. and those intuitions are formed, you know, in a lot of ways, their culture, their family, their background, their language, their genetics, their personality. And they're, you know, they're not necessarily irrational, but they're pre-rational. And the way to persuade people of a religious point of view is not just to hammer them with argument, but to begin to speak as well to those pre-rational considerations.
Yes.
Which is why things like relationship and friendship are so critical to evangelism, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to open people up to the possibility, not just that the arguments are true, but that the world to which they invite you is itself appealing. You know, like, what if I gave you a lock-solid, irrefutable proof that the Klingon God was real, right? Like, you wouldn't want reality to be that way. I mean, you'd be like, you know, arguments be darned. I'm going to die in the Federation. I'm not going to become a Klingon. You know, I don't care what the argument says. Like, this is my home, right? And so you have to get where you can home people into the Catholic faith and not just argue them into it. And that's one of the reasons that Bishop Barron, when he made his beautiful PBS series Catholicism, he didn't lead with argument. He led with beauty.
Yes,
he led with beauty. You know, so that you. Apologetics, I read a cynic one time who said apologetics is the art of wanting religion to be true because it was beneficial to you.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a fair amount of truth in that. Like, apologetics works on people who have already got to the point where they want to have an answer, right? Where they show me that this thing is intelligible. Show me that it makes sense, because my heart is drawing me and my intellect wants to come along. Make that path for me, you know? And so what happens when you listen to a radio show over months and months and months is you get more than argument.
Mm-hmm.
You begin to build a context in which you can actually imagine a world in which the truth of the Catholic faith is not only compelling but attractive.
Emma, thank you so much for your call from Hayden, Idaho. In a moment, we'll be talking with Mike in Spokane, Washington, Lawrence in Raleigh, North Carolina, Joyce in Carmel, Indiana. A couple lines open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. It's called a Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-298-3986. Congratulations going out to another longtime EWTN radio partner, the great Domestic Church Media in New Jersey, marking 17 years with us. They have five radio stations in Trenton, Asbury Park, Cape May, Freehold, and Hamilton, New Jersey. Congratulations to Jim and Cheryl from Manfredonia and their great team there at Domestic Church Media. From your friends here at EWTN. Before the break, we had a great call from Emma in Idaho, who used to, I guess, rage at the machine. She was sort of, yelling back at her radio when you were on. And eventually, she, I guess, started listening and saying, oh, wait a minute, that actually makes sense. And it reminded me of a friend of ours, a mutual friend of ours, who some years ago was a rocket scientist in Huntsville, Alabama, blowing things up and, learning how to, what would happen. One night he came home, cracked open a beer, and turned on the TV, just sort of channel surfing, and he goes, oh, look at this, an angry nun. This ought to be interesting. But the more he watched, he said, oh, wait a minute, she's right about that. Long story short, my wife sang for his ordination.
Yep.
Some years ago. He's a very, very happy man in his priesthood, and it's all because of, the truth getting out there and being in receive mode same time.
I'm not letting any cats out of the bag if I acknowledge that Mother Angelica had a quirky method, all right? She had a quirky method. She was unlike other people in her personality.
Yeah.
And I've heard more than one story of somebody that flipped on Mother Angelica because they were inclined to make fun of her. Right, they saw her. Oh, this is ridiculous! Look at this Catholic nun, and the next thing you know,
boom!
This Catholic nun has got a lot of wisdom, and they're becoming Catholic.
Better believe it. Let's go now to Mike in Spokane, Washington, and Mike is listening to us on Sacred Heart Radio. There, hey, Mike, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, thank you both for taking my call. Thank you, Dr. David. You mentioned the Roadrunner and the coyote. I'm still laughing every time I think about that.
Me, meep.
Her Hogan's heroes, Colonel Klink, where no one escapes from the prison. Well, my question or comment is, in today's world, how do we become more like St. Francis of Assisi or St. Maximilian Kolbe, who gave his life for another person in the Auschwitz? Or Pope Francis, who always talked of mercy and forgiveness.
Yeah. So you're Mike, right?
Yes.
Okay. So Mike, here's my counsel. I think that we need to not worry about becoming like St. Francis or Maximilian Kolbe or Pope Francis, and worry about how can I become St. Mike? How can I become St. Tom? How can I become St. David? And one of the virtues of studying the lives of the Catholic saints is when you realize how drastically different they all are from one another. Chesterton has a wonderful little book. He has two wonderful little books, one about St. Francis of Assisi and one about St. Thomas Aquinas, not St. Dominic, St. Thomas.
Hmm.
And in the book, he draws attention in each of those books to the difference that the one had from the other. You couldn't have gotten two more radically divergent personalities than Thomas and Francis. I mean, Francis is, he's zipping around all over Europe, left and right, and doing, dashing off for wild escapades as the troubadour for the Lord, and a deeply charismatic personality that attracted people to him like flies to honey. And Thomas was the most stolid, boring, sedentary, unexciting guy on the planet. There's a story about St. Thomas that, when he was still a novice in the Dominican order, he was Brother Thomas, they're in class in the studium, the Dominican studium, and somebody says, Brother Thomas, there's a flying ass outside. And he hoists his ponderous bulk out of the chair and wanders over and looks out the window. And of course, all the brothers just die laughing. And he turns around without even cracking a smile and he says, I would sooner believe that a donkey could fly than that a Dominican could lie.
Ooh.
And goes and sits back down, completely different from St. Francis, And because of that, you realize, and if you read the spiritual writers, you could read Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Francis de Sales, you could read, Climacus, you read Augustine, you read Bernard of Clairvaux, you name it. They all have a system. And you start reading enough of these books, you realize, wait a minute, this guy's system is different from that guy's system. wait, there's five different saints, five different systems. Aha, I'm learning something.
Uh-huh.
It ain't about the system.
Right.
All right, it ain't about the system. And what all these guys have in common, and girls too, what they all have in common, right, is the determination to surrender their unique personality. And they're all, our personalities are unique. And their circumstances and their vocation, to surrender their personality and vocation to this higher aim of following Christ in the world, right? And that looks different depending on the context, right? If you are a married man with a wife and children, your discipleship is very different from St. Francis. I love the fact that in the Gospels, Jesus tells the rich young ruler, sell everything, come and follow me. Zacchaeus says, I'm selling half. Jesus says, salvation has come to this house.
Yeah.
And to the Gerasene demoniac, he says, Jesus, I want to leave everything and follow you. That's exactly what he had told the rich young ruler to do in Mark 10. What does he say to the Gerasene demoniac? No, 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 no. You've suffered enough. Go home and tell your family what he's done for you. He gives three different pieces of advice to three different people.
Yep.
Right? John the Baptist does the same thing. He gives the soldiers one piece of advice. He gives the tax collectors another piece of advice. That's not the common element. The common element is, how do I, whatever my circumstance, how do I surrender this, right, and put it in service of the Lord? Now, my answer to that question, how do you do that, right? St. Paul lays out the problem in Romans 7, which is that I want to do the good and I find myself not doing it.
Yep.
All right. And the disciplines of the Catholic life are designed to cure, to their therapy for the self-deceptive, self-destructive practices that corrupt our lives and our moral lives, right? So self-knowledge, like radical self-knowledge and humility, coming face-to-face with who I really am, is critical. Teresa of Avila says that's the key ingredient. If you don't have that genuinely humble self-insight, mm-hmm. you can't make any progress because you don't know what to fix, right? And you know, when I was in seminary, I had a seminary professor who said he got really tired of young seminarians that would come to him and say, I would like you to disciple me. And he had gotten really cynical about that because he would say, well, okay. And they would come and they would start to meet with him, and he would begin to learn something about their lives and personalities, and he would begin to make suggestions. Oh, no, 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 I can't do that. Right? And he was like, well, this is a lost cause, because they don't really want to be discipled. They don't want to be challenged and changed about the things in their life that have to go. Right?
Yeah.
And so finding those things in your life that keep you, you know, whether it's passive-aggressive or lustful or overly aggressive or proud, and mm-hmm. really honestly coming to confront those demons of your personality that need to go and getting rid of them. That's step one in the spiritual life for everybody, regardless of your mode of life.
Mike, thanks so much for your call from Spokane today. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Lawrence now. Lawrence is in Raleigh, North Carolina, listening on iHeartRadio. Hey, Raleigh, Lawrence, what's on your mind today?
Yes, Mr. Anders, we have to, you have said that we have to understand Genesis and the creation story as an allegory. So given that, how do we understand the fall of man and original sin, and therefore the need for redemption in real world terms? That is how.
Yeah, thank you. So this is the point that Pius XII, he put his finger right on this point, and he said, whatever interpretation you give of Genesis, it must retain the centrality of the parallelism between Christ and Adam. Though what we lost in Adam, we regain in Christ.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we traditionally the Catholic faith regards the consequence of Adam's sin is resulting in certain wounds of the spirit, right? And they are things like concupiscence, our immoderate attachment to bodily pleasure, ignorance. And ignorance doesn't mean that I don't know my arithmetic. It means that I don't know how to extricate myself from my spiritual and moral dilemma, right? Ignorance of my true good, right? Moral weakness, which is different from concupiscence, right? Moral weakness is just I lack the strength to pull myself up by my own moral bootstraps, right? And malice or egotism, which is you know the the tendency that we all have to consider our own good disproportionately relative to our neighbors. Those things are not in themselves sin. They are the occasions of sin, right? They prompt us to sin. They're not actual sins.
Okay.
I mean, having an immoderate appetite for bodily pleasure is not a sin. Indulging it by eating three pecan pies, that's the sin, right?
Sure.
And so being conscious of that, being conscious of what are the wounds of my spirit that need to be healed, and then taking seriously the redemption of Christ as the curative alternative, right? So Christ models for me, well, the opposite of all those things. I mean, Christ is, he's certainly not spiritually weak. He certainly doesn't succumb to concupiscence. He's certainly not afflicted by malice or egotism. And he's certainly not knocking knowledge. I have come to do your will, right? This thing alone I came to do, the will of God, you know? And so he models for us the opposite of those weaknesses, and then entering into the mystery of Christ's passion, death, and resurrection, right? And believing that those things can be affected in our own personality through Jesus Christ, we begin to heal the wounds of original sin. Hence St. Irenaeus' words, what we lost in Adam, we regain in Christ.
Lawrence, thanks so much for your call today from Raleigh, North Carolina. Call to Communion here on EWTN. If I may, I might like to tell you about a wonderful program we air every weekday morning here on EWTN on the radio side, and that would be Fire on the Earth. Peter Herbeck providing a compelling look at the new evangelization through inspired teachings, interviews, testimonies. Peter's insights will help Catholics acquire the tools they need to do their part in the new evangelization, which we're all called to. A wonderful program if you're up early, Monday through Friday morning, 5:15 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio, Fire on the Earth. A great, great show. Let's go now to James in Mobile, Alabama, listening on the fantastic Archangel Radio, AM 1410. Hey there, James, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I got into a recent debate about, I was called a Roman Catholic. I said, I'm a Catholic who happens to attend a Latin Rite church, but I can go to a number of different rites of the Catholic Church to celebrate Mass or to join in the Mass, and it's Roman Catholic was intended, as I understand it, as a pejorative by Protestants to try to separate American Catholics from being, quote, true Americans because our alleged allegiance was to Rome and not under our Constitution as far as a national government. And so my question really is, I always have corrected people who have claimed, you're a Roman Catholic. I said, I'm a Catholic, and have talked to them briefly about the number of different rites of the church, but we're all Catholics. Anyway, I just wanted to get your input on that.
Thank you. So, you know, in the creed, we don't say, I believe in one holy Roman Catholic and Apostolic Church.
No.
We confess belief in one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church. Now, within the one holy Catholic Apostolic Church, the Apostolic See of Rome has a special significance and is part of the Church's constitution in a unique way, and that's part of Catholic identity. But you're correct about the way we differentiate the rites, the Latin rite from the other Eastern rites. I think you're also correct about the use of the English phrase Roman Catholic as a pejorative. I do believe that originates in 16th century English Protestant polemics against Catholics, right? Because, see, one of the conceits of the English Reformation was that they were Catholic, right? That was one of their pretensions, right? That they were English Catholics, and those folks over in Italy were Roman Catholics, and they were trying to lay claim to the Catholic mantle, right? And differentiating in that way.
So there you go, Mary. James, thanks so much for your call. We hope that helped things for you. One of our YouTube listeners today is Matt. Matt says, according to Aquinas, love is, quote, willing the good of the other. Well, if that's the case, how do we love God since he is all good?
Yeah, okay. So you will the good that God is.
Okay.
You don't will good for God as if God were somehow in need of good. and you are desirous that God come into the good that he lacks. No, God is the standard and the ground of goodness, so you simply will the good that God is. When you are loving any good thing or any proportionate thing or loving anything in a good way, you're doing so by means of the goodness that is a participant in God's very own act of being, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the way we love God is by loving the God-like aspects of our neighbors, loving our own good for God's sake, loving the good that he's put in the world for God's sake. That's how we love God. We can't love God as a focal object, right? Because I can't know him that way,
sure,
as a focal object, right?
Sure.
I know God by inference and by participation, but not, you know, but not by direct apprehension.
Okay, Matt, thanks so much for your call via YouTube, actually your message here. Also watching us today on YouTube is Wanda. Wanda says, my mother-in-law is a very devout Baptist. She has a great relationship with Christ. Seeing how much she loves and trusts Jesus, I can't help but feel if she understood the real presence in the Eucharist, what would be the best way to explain that to her?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I understand the impulse very well. I question whether the best way to approach your mother-in-law with the Catholic faith is to offer an apology for a singular Catholic doctrine, mm-hmm, even if that doctrine is something as august and noble as the Eucharist. And I say that because I don't know your mother-in-law. I don't know her personality. I don't know her history with Catholicism. It's possible that the Eucharist is the best possible way into the church for her, but it's not the only way into the church, right? And so my experience has taught me that when people become Catholic, they all end up in the same place, but they do so for very different motives. Like, I have a very good friend who became Catholic because he was heavily involved in the Protestant pro-life movement. And, you know, he's out there on the picket lines and praying in front of abortion clinics and this kind of business. And he's looking around going, who are all these strange people here with these weird plastic beads, you know? And he began to realize that the Catholic Church had the most vigorous, consistent ethic of life of any Christian party.
Yeah.
And he said, man, I need to get me some of that, right? And that was his path in. You know, my path in was through historical study. My wife came back to the practice of the Catholic faith because of the insight, wisdom, and compassion of a particular cleric. On and on and on the story goes, right?
Yeah.
And so I think the important thing is to be in relationship with your mother-in-law, to live your own faith generously, and hopefully to invite questions, right? Because a lot of times Baptists have this idea that Catholics can't have a vigorous spirituality, that they don't know Jesus, that there's something deficient about Catholic life, or if you have a good spirituality, that it's in spite of, not because of your Catholic faith. And so, you know, kind of living the contradiction to those stereotypes in a way that would invite curiosity, and then allowing that to organically develop into questions that she might ask about the things that are either of interest or hang-ups for her. And a lot of people disagree with me about that, and that's fine. Go ahead and disagree. I think that we do a disservice to the Eucharist if we abstract the question of the real presence from the larger question of the Eucharistic sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that John Paul talks about in his encyclical Ecclesia De Eucharistia. He talks about the danger of dismissing or deflecting from or diminishing somehow the sacrificial significance of the Eucharist. And the Second Vatican Council, when it talked about the Eucharist as the source and summit of the faith, that's probably the most misquoted passage of all the council documents. Because a lot of people hear that and they think, oh, he's talking about the real presence. No, that's not what the documents say. They actually say that the source and summit of the faith is not the Eucharist, but the Eucharistic sacrifice. And that the Eucharist is first and foremost the centerpiece of a liturgical rite that is a sacrificial act. And the reason the Eucharist is source and summit is not just because of the real presence, crucial as that is because the real presence is the victim that we offer to God and ourselves along with him, right? So here, it makes a difference in the way you think about and experience the Eucharist. If I think about the Eucharist as something that I passively receive, oh, here's my Jesus pill that jazzes me up, right? That's a very kind of egocentric way of thinking about it. If I think about the Eucharist as, oh, here's something that I offer to Almighty God in thanksgiving. Mm. That's a completely different trajectory. The dynamism changes, right?
Yeah.
And along with it, my personality, because the reason it's Source and Summit is that the Eucharist is the way that I come to share in Christ's own intentions. I become to see the world as Christ sees it. I come to, as St. Paul says, have the mind in you that was in Christ Jesus, who was humble in obedience even to death on a cross, right? If the Eucharist works within me that transformative experience of self-sacrifice, offer your bodies as living sacrifice, Paul says, this is your spiritual act of worship, then it is sanctifying me, making me more and more like Jesus, right? That's the way it becomes Source and Summit to me. It is possible for me to narcissistically go to Mass and be lost in awe and reverence and wonder at my own holiness, right? And I say to myself, look at me here on my knees, reverently receiving the Eucharist. Aren't I a good, pious Catholic?
How about me?
How about me? Look at me in all my holiness, right? Mm. And it's very easy to do. It's tantalizingly easy to fall in love with my own feelings of elevation or transcendence or wonder or passion or beauty or whatnot. And St. John of the Cross warns against that. He warns against it. He says, better to approach the sacraments with no affect, zero emotionality, than to think that I'm so spiritual because of my spiritual feelings.
Yeah.
Because spirituality is not a matter of feelings, it's a matter of sacrificial action. That's the way to understand the Eucharist. Does it move me to faith, hope, and charity and service to my neighbor and love of God? And so that's the way to do it. So however that reality becomes manifest in your life in a way that's transformative and powerful and visible, then you become what Christ calls the salt of the earth, the light of the world. And you can't help but be attractive to Baptists and everybody else around you.
Sure. Wanda, thanks for your question today via YouTube. Here's another YouTube question from Chris in Denver. Chris wants to know, if one is in the state of grace but venially sins, does the venial sin weakens one's ability to love God and neighbor?
Well, that's just what sin is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sin is just deflecting from the perfect love of God and neighbor. We can deflect totally, or we can deflect a little bit, right? If you deflect a little bit, you've deflected a little bit,
right?
So better not to deflect.
Yeah, don't do that. And Chris in Denver, thanks for watching us today on YouTube. This question from Miles, also on YouTube. Please explain radical cenation, convalidation, where the Catholic Church requires converts to get remarried in a Catholic ceremony.
Yes. Okay, so radical cenation, let's say that you want to have your marriage convalidated in the Catholic Church. Let's say you're Catholic, you marry a non-Catholic, you marry your non-Catholic wife in her Baptist church. It's not a valid marriage. 10 years go by, and you realize, man, I need to reconcile with the church. You go to the priest. The priest says, okay, what we have to do here is you have to have a convalidation ceremony. Come say your vows again in front of the priest, and your marriage will be valid in the Catholic Church. And you go home and say, honey, I've got a great idea. Father's willing to meet us next Thursday at the parish. We can repeat our Catholic vows, and we can be married in the Catholic Church. Isn't that great? And wife says, I'm a Baptist. I was born a Baptist. I'm a die Baptist. You know, I told you when we got married, I wouldn't have anything to do with that Catholic stuff, and I'm not about to go stand in front of a Catholic priest and say my vows. I said them once. I meant them. I'm married. End of discussion, period, end of paragraph. Don't ever bring it up to me again. Go away, poo, right? And you're like, okay, I'm stuck. How can I convalidate my marriage? Because my wife completely refuses to go along with it, right? So the church has this neat little procedure called radical cenation. Here are the requirements. She still wants to be married to you.
That's it?
Yep. She still intends to remain with you in conjugal living, right, from hell till death. So she hasn't revoked that intent. Okay.
Okay. All right.
The church has a procedure for declaring your marriage valid without her active participation in the rite of convalidation. That's what radical cenation is. And more than once on this show, I have taught people about radical cenation, and they have called in afterwards and said, that was the ticket. I mean, I didn't think I'd ever get my marriage convalidated, but I mentioned radical cenation to my priest, and we got it done.
Isn't that an awesome thing?
It's amazing.
That the church would offer this.
Yeah, now what's more often is I give out canon law advice, and then some canonist writes me and says, Anders, stay in your lane, buddy. You're a historian. You don't know what you're talking about with this radical sedation business. You know, stay away from canon law. But on this one, I actually got it right.
So you're on solid ground.
I'm on solid ground.
I'm glad to hear that. Miles, thanks for watching us on YouTube today. Great way to end the program. Dr. David Anders, thank you,
my
friend.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do it right here on EWTN, on the radio side of EWTN. Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern. You can check out our podcast 24/7 by going to the absolutely amazing EWTN Podcast Central. I'm not just saying that. I mean it. Over 100 fantastic podcasts, not only programs that we do, but some of our partners all over the world. Here's how you get there. EWTN.com/podcasts, EWTN.com/podcasts. If you look for the Call to Communion podcast, because these are in alphabetical order, you'll find it just a little bit down. So on behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a wonderful and blessed day. We'll see you next time. God bless.